Hi, I'm Steve Clements, and I have a question. Is NATO more divided than we think? And how will its internal rifts affect the future of Ukraine and Russia's course? Let's get to the bottom line. Since the start of the war in Ukraine 3 months ago, NATO officials have been saying that the alliance has been recharged with a strong sense of purpose and new accomplishment. After all, NATO's support has propped up Ukraine to defend itself against one of the biggest militaries in the world, Russia, and maybe even forced Moscow to rethink its objectives for the war. And just a couple of years ago, French President Emmanuel Macron was warning that NATO was becoming brain dead, and former U.S. President Donald Trump was saying it was obsolete. But are things really as rosy inside the world's biggest military alliance? Is it too early for NATO to be celebrating this triumph? And where does the driving force of NATO, meaning the United States, really want the war in Ukraine to go? Today we're talking with the former National Security Advisor of the White House, John Bolton, who served under the Trump administration, and before that as ambassador to the United Nations under former President George W. Bush, and many other roles in the U.S. government. He's also author of The Room Where It Happened, a White House memoir. Ambassador Bolton, terrific to be with you today. And look, I've just returned from Eastern Europe, a couple of trips to Eastern Europe, and, you know, we hear about NATO being revived, never have been this strong alliance, and you've been saying, hey, things aren't quite as rosy inside the relationship as they're painted to be today. What's wrong from your perspective about NATO and perhaps America's approach to it right now?
Well, I think NATO is united in opposition to the Russian invasion. That's the good news. If it wasn't, it would be stunningly bad.
But NATO's opposed now. Where was it, say, 6 months ago?
Right. This is a process, as they like to say. And at the beginning and today, there are still significant divisions within NATO about how to respond, what the outcome should be, and a number of other important issues. There have certainly been some improvements. Finland and Sweden joining NATO strengthen the alliance. Some countries have come to the realization they have to do more in terms of providing for their own self-defense and their contribution within NATO, but there's still many political disagreements about the road ahead. So I think it's a mistake to get self-congratulatory about how united NATO is, because that simply masks problems we will see in the very near future.
Well, not too long ago, President Trump, whom you served, was saying NATO was obsolete. And as you wrote, you sort of saw him wanting to withdraw from NATO. We heard President Macron saying NATO had become brain dead. And this was in the very near, our near history of what happened. Can it be flipped on a switch that fast? Because what I sort of see around the world is a lot of doubt on America's willingness to remain there for our allies' dark days. That may be going right now, but not sustainable.
Well, I think American credibility is on the line here with respect to Ukraine. And I think there's a history there. Certainly part of it, a good part of it, is due to Trump's evident desire to get out of NATO at some point. But the history goes before that. The U.S. did not respond to Russia's August 2000 invasion of Georgia effectively. The United States did not respond effectively to the first invasion of Ukraine in 2014. The whole world saw the debacle of the American withdrawal from Afghanistan in the summer of 2021. So doubts about America's staying power, I think, are in the minds of many people around the world. And there is concern that the United States can't make a commitment which can be depended on for a defined length of time. That was not the case during the Cold War. It's become true more recently, and it's an urgent problem for our politicians.
So I notice you're very careful with words, and I've been watching your interviews of late, and you are the only one I hear on television talking about Russia's second invasion of Ukraine and critiquing President Biden's framing if they further invade. Did we create the conditions for appeasement of what had happened, what Russia had done previously in Ukraine?
I think we are largely responsible for it, and we are the leaders of NATO, whether we like it or not, and we have to take that responsibility. The fact that the United States and the NATO alliance did not impose stiffer sanctions on Russia after the 2014 invasion and annexation of Crimea, I think led Putin to believe he could get away with it again. And in the critical days before February the 24th, when Russian forces crossed the Ukrainian border, the United States specifically ruled out sanctions before the invasion began, when we would have been perfectly legitimate in saying that these were sanctions respecting 2014 or sanctions against the buildup of Russian forces and the threat they pose to Ukraine. These were all factors that I think in Putin's mind and the minds of his advisors led him to think that we were big on rhetoric but short on action.
Now, the John Bolton that I've been reading for many years is not really a sanctions guy. In fact, you've written that we've applied sanctions to many other countries, including Russia or Cuba or North Korea, and they've never really worked out, and that sanctions, in your mind, are not the kind of deterrence factor that Vladimir Putin would take seriously. So I guess in light of that, where am I misreading you in terms of talking about sanctions now, and should we have done something more forceful earlier?
Well, sanctions are kind of a shorthand for tougher measures we could have taken. My reading of sanctions, and I've been involved in a lot of them over the years, as you say, is that they're most likely to be effective if they're broad and comprehensive, if they're swiftly and unexpectedly applied, and if they're enforced with military force if need be. None of that has been true in the case of the Ukraine sanctions or the sanctions that were threatened before the Russian invasion. A sanctions best day is the day it's announced.
After that, Rhodes.
Exactly, because the target takes steps to mitigate the damage, takes steps to evade the sanctions. So enforcement becomes critical, and here's another breach in NATO's unity. Enforcement has not been uniform. Sanctions do impose costs. Sometimes those costs are sufficient to change your target's behavior. Sometimes the cost alone slow them down. But unless you can show that the sanctions really will have a fundamental effect, other deterrent steps are necessary. In the case of Ukraine, for example, stationing American and other NATO forces in Ukraine before Russia took action might have been a necessary deterrent.
Look, we've been looking at Ukraine and NATO, but we have a whole world out there in which American credibility is being tested, and one of the areas where it's being tested is Asia. And the big news this week is President Biden has come out and said that the United States would militarily defend Taiwan against a Chinese incursion. I don't think I've heard a U.S. president that clearly articulate American military involvement in Taiwan. We've always had strategic ambiguity. Is this a big factor? And is this an area where John Bolton would support what President Biden has just laid out?
Well, I would certainly support what Biden said in answer to the response at the press conference. What I don't support is what the White House then rolled back after his statement, which simply said, well, the president was just repeating existing policy, which he clearly wasn't. And anybody who wants to watch the Q&A again will clearly get that point. I do think China can be deterred in the case of Taiwan. I don't think China wants to inherit a heap of smoking rubble. I think they want Taiwan's full productive capabilities, especially in the chip area, critical for computers and our high-tech civilization. And I think they're watching what we're doing and what we're not doing in Ukraine very quickly. What they want is for Taiwan to fall into their lap like a piece of ripe fruit, which could be done in their minds through a confrontation with the United States where we back away. That's why this debate in the United States about China in the 21st century is so important, because if we were to lose Taiwan, I think it would set us back in ways that would be extraordinarily difficult to recover from.
You know, one of the things you've said, which I admire, is that we in the media are always looking to understand the next chess move when 20 moves have already been made, and we might have gone back there. And we've talked a little bit about Russia and what we might have done one way or another. And, of course, I think you know that I was first executive director of the Nixon Center years ago, and Nixon was more of a realist in these sorts of issues and was of the view that we needed to do more with Russia, that Russia was humiliated from the economic shock therapy, and there were a lot of missteps taken with Russia. How would you have recommended 20 steps ago that we might not have been repeating history and falling back into kind of some form of a new Cold War with Russia? What did we get wrong 20 steps ago that we should be aware of now?
Well, I think if you start from January the 1st, 1992, the day after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, there was enormous optimism in Washington. It continued through the 1990s. Some commentators were announcing the end of history. People talked about the peace dividend, where Western defense budgets were cuts. But most importantly, during the 1990s, the Clinton administration, people in Washington felt that the debate was over, that the Washington model of liberal democracy and market economics was going to prevail worldwide, and there really wasn't too much more to worry about. That turned out not to be right in Russia. And our failure to understand just how fragile Russia was, how difficult getting institutions of representative government in place would be, and how hard it was to decommunize a country. You know, there have been a lot of countries that have gone through being socialized, but there never was one successfully decommunized. And so our optimism in the 1990s led us not to pay adequate attention to exactly what Russia was going through, from which a lot of the pain that you now see, I think, emerged.
There are a lot of memes in the media right now about Russia, and I'd just love to get your sense of it. You mentioned in your memoir that you met Putin in 2001. You've had other encounters with him. You have a sense of that system and have been thinking about it a long time. But a lot of things running in the media right now are maybe Putin is ill, maybe that this is Putin's war and not Russia's war, that the Russian military is really weak, it turns out. I'm just interested in what you see as the North Star in getting the framing right on how to perceive Russia, because I see a lot of conflicting and even contradictory messages right now out in the media about how to approach that system, which we've been looking at for generations, and we seem to be getting it wrong.
Well, you're constantly learning where mistakes have been made, and we've made a lot here. I think it's a big mistake to characterize this as Putin's war, that it's one man's decision. Certainly, he's the top official. They are his decisions. But do not underestimate how strongly many Russians feel, not because of propaganda, but by long history, about the breakup of the Soviet Union. Putin and his close advisors see it as illegitimate. They think Ukraine's an illegitimate state. They think it's a failed state. They think it's part of the Rodinia, Mother Russia, and they want it back. I don't think we calculated nearly how much the breakup of the Soviet Union affected these people. I'm not saying their reaction is justified, but it's not a good thing to engage in mirror imaging, that if I'm a reasonable person, I look across the table, they look like reasonable people, we'll just find common solutions to common problems. It doesn't work like that, and we're seeing that today in Russia. A lot of Russians strongly support what Putin is doing. If anything, they don't feel he's gone far enough.
And I'd just love to get John Bolton's list of what needs to be on that list to further deter or choke Putin's ambitions.
Well, I think our biggest mistake in NATO over the years was after we expanded, not because we were rushing to get close to Russia's border. These countries wanted protection, and we brought them into NATO, but we did not close the gap. We left a gray zone between NATO's eastern border and Russia's western border. Remembering, Russia, Soviet Union have never crossed a NATO border with armed force. We created zones of ambiguity, Ukraine, Moldova, and Belarus, the countries in the Caucasus mountain region, the Central Asian republics that were neither Russian nor NATO anymore. And that zone of ambiguity was an invitation to interference from Russia, which is what we've seen in Ukraine. We need now to come to a clearer decision what our objectives are and whether we're going to bring some of these countries into NATO or what arrangements we're going to have.
What is your recommendation?
Well, I think we've got to find something. If we can't have full NATO membership for, let's say, Ukraine, because there are Russian troops on its territory and NATO has never taken in a member in that circumstance, some other kinds of security guarantees to make it clear to Putin that merely not being in NATO is not a license for Russia to do what it wants. I don't think we thought that through after the last NATO expansion. Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania would have been much easier militarily to go after than Ukraine, as it turns out. Russia hasn't done that because they're NATO countries.
Do you think that this war, if it goes on, grinds the Ukrainians down more or the Russians down more? You've been concerned that Putin may play the long game here, and we would be watching the Ukrainian military, these valiant people defending their nation, is so much more than we actually thought was going to happen. Whether or not that would be the tragedy we can't allow to happen, or whether or not this war somehow is actually dragging Russia into something even much worse than its Afghanistan when it was occupying and invading there.
Well, I think Ukraine is suffering disproportionately.
Right.
I mean, the war is being fought on its territory. The total capital destruction, leave aside the human tragedy,
right,
the capital destruction of infrastructure, housing, manufacturing, almost incalculable. Russia has a silent partner here. Russia and China have an entente, to use a French diplomatic word, maybe not a full-up alliance. China's got Russia's back. Russian financial institutions that are facing sanctions can launder their money through Chinese banks. China can buy Russian oil and gas that it can't sell to Europe. That'll work in the other direction if China goes after Taiwan or the South China Sea. But Russia's got deeper resources than Ukraine does. And in a war of attrition, Ukraine is more likely to succumb. And Russia's patient. To say again, the invasion of Georgia was 2008. Russia waited 6 years for the first invasion of Ukraine and waited another eight for the second invasion. This is the kind of long horizon that is very unfamiliar to Americans who look at quarterly reports. So I think that President Duda of Poland is right to be worried. I think that's why the Central and Eastern European members of NATO have been so strong in advocating backing Zelensky and the Ukrainians, and why after decades of ideologically based isolation of neutrality that Finland and Sweden have now asked to join NATO. They've seen the reality. In Western Europe, not so much.
You know, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, as well as President Macron in France, have called for a ceasefire. I can't tell right now whether Lloyd Austin's statement was official government policy or not. But what would be wrong from your perspective, if anything, with pursuing a ceasefire strategy at this moment?
Well, first, let me distinguish between temporary, transitory ceasefires to provide humanitarian corridors to get civilians out of the conflict. That's warranted in almost any circumstance. The risk here is that if the parties declare a ceasefire, they would each hold the territory that their forces control. And for the Russians, that demarcation line could become permanent, with everything on the Russian side of it annexed to Russia, as Crimea was before. So I would be very worried if I were Volodymyr Zelensky about any ceasefire where my troops are not only on the offensive, but are taking back significant chunks of territory and maybe even more. Because once it stops, I think it'll be very difficult to gin up support for Ukraine to the level it has been.
This last week, I heard U.S. Ambassador to NATO Julianne Smith say we were looking for the strategic defeat of Russia in this case. What do you think constitutes strategic defeat?
You know, that's a term I do not understand. The term I do understand is victory. Mm. How would I define victory? I think I'd define it the same way that the Ukrainians would. And it is stated U.S. policy right now that the government of Ukraine should have sovereignty over and full territorial integrity of Ukraine as of the time it became independent. That means not just the territory Russia's taken since February 24th, but the two fake republics in the Donbass region that were declared in 2014 and return of the Crimea. Now, that may not be achievable immediately, but and there are many other issues, reparations, responsibility for the war, but this is a territorial war, and that is something we need to make up for U.S. purposes, what we consider our objectives to be.
One of the hallmarks of this conflict that the Biden administration is proud of is that it shared real intelligence that we had on Vladimir Putin's decision-making and his likely decision to go to war. A lot of our allies thought we were warmongering and didn't take us seriously. I guess the question I have is, did the Biden administration not believe its own intelligence, that should we not have pre-positioned much more material and support early on to have a definitive impact than we did? Because it seems to me to be a contradiction that on one hand, you know Putin and Russia are going to invade, and on the other hand, we were bungling and bureaucratically complicated about what we were going to provide, and that as we were going through these steps, we were very reactive to conditions on the ground as opposed to our own intelligence. I have not asked anyone. I haven't seen that debate anywhere, but I'm interested in what you think.
Well, I think the public sharing of intelligence that we saw before and during this war has been a mistake. I don't think it was part of a strategy. I think it was the Biden administration saying implicitly, we know how badly we bungled Afghanistan, but we're going to tell you how much we know to show you we really are on top of things in Ukraine. And I think you put your finger on the biggest danger. We had an enormous intelligence mistake here. The Russians weren't the only ones who misestimated what the impact of their invasion would be. They thought it would be over in a matter of weeks, and so did we. That's why we were leaking, the Biden administration was leaking our support.
I mean, they thought it was going to be like Afghanistan.
Right.
It was going to be another case of Ashraf Ghani leaving the country, right?
Well, that's right. And that's why we were projecting support for guerrilla operations against the Russian invasion. That doesn't say we had much confidence. And that's why we offered Zelensky a ride out of Kiev, which he rightly refused. That doesn't show confidence in the survivability of his government. So when you reveal all these things without a strategic framework, as opposed to sharing them privately with allies, I think you risk really exposing a lot of your sources and methods. I think the U.S. does need overall a massive increase in its international communications capabilities. The Cold War institutions we had, which are iconic now, are dilapidated and in disrepair. They need to be improved. And declassifying intelligence is not a substitute for a communication strategy.
I know this may seem like an unfair question, and I don't want it to because it's a hypothetical, and it's really about what would have happened under a Trump administration right now. You've said it would be bunk that the Trump administration would have avoided this conflict, that it would have been drawn in. We may see a future Trump administration come in. It raises the interesting questions about what the scaffolding of a Trump national security posture with real tests of American power, both in Asia and in Europe, are going on. And I'd just be interested in what insights you have about President Trump and whether or not this system that we have would behave responsibly and credibly in that administration as opposed to some of the criticisms you've had of the Biden administration.
Well, at least in the Biden administration, you have systematic decision making. That didn't exist in the Trump administration. I described it as like living inside a pinball machine, particularly since Trump doesn't have a philosophy and he doesn't do policy in the normal sense of the word. I think the reason that there was no invasion of Ukraine under Trump was that Putin thought that Trump was, in a way, doing the work he would have liked to have seen done in weakening NATO, perhaps ultimately withdrawing from it, putting pressure on Zelensky to do political favors for Trump, preventing the closeness that you would want to see between the leader of the United States and the leader of Ukraine. So in a second Trump term, I think Ukraine would have been much more vulnerable. And I think it may well have been. There would have been no leadership of NATO, and Kyiv and the country as a whole might well have fallen in a few weeks.
Let me just ask you real quick, finally. NATO is an international institution that you support, a multilateral institution you support. What is the criteria for you of those multilateral institutions the United States should be engaged with in part and those that we should sidestep or avoid?
The question is, does it advance the interest of the United States? I'm not a unilateralist. I'm not a multilateralist. I'm pro-American. If it benefits the U.S., NATO does, the Proliferation Security Initiative does, many others don't. That's the test, and it's really, in many senses, a test of effectiveness.
Ambassador John Bolton, former National Security Advisor to President Trump, former ambassador to the United Nations, and author of the book, The Room Where It Happened, a White House memoir. Thanks so much for sharing your views with us today. So what's the bottom line? The world is in chaos, and power is really up for grabs. China, India, Russia, and other nations want to be seen as superpowers. To them, America seems really erratic right now, up and down, uncomfortable with its own superpower status, and radically changing direction every few years. So whether it's Ukraine or Taiwan or elsewhere, the United States and its allies are being constantly tested. Putin is testing the resolve of the West. Is NATO really revived? Is this feeling of new purpose in the world's most powerful alliance going to last? My guest says much more has to be done on that front. Meanwhile, behind the curtains, China is watching and learning carefully. And that's the bottom line.